Happy Monday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It's the first podcast that we have recorded in the spring of 2022. So happy spring, Will Salatan.
Thank you, Charlie. I'm very excited about the daylight savings.
Yeah, I am excited about it. Don't get me started. Just don't get me started on daylight savings. So let's just set the scene where we're at here on the war in Ukraine. Some of this stuff is just hard to get your head around. This report that the war has caused more than 10 million people to abandon their homes. That's 10 million people in just 3 weeks. Ukrainian officials yesterday accused Russia of bombing an art school in Mariupol, where 400 people had been sheltering in recent days. And of course, this comes days after they had bombed a theater that had maybe as many as 1,000 people, including children. We also got this report over the weekend that Russia attacked a care home, a nursing home in eastern Ukraine, killing 56 elderly residents. And it increasingly looks like Russian forces will continue to bomb and bombard cities, killing civilians as the war settles into this brutal stalemate. So give me your sense, Will, where we're at. I mean, this seems to be the conventional wisdom now. I don't mean that in a negative way, but the military experts seem to be saying that it's very clear that the Russian plan A has failed, and yet this is going to be bloodier and more brutal than ever, because this is now the strategy that the Russians have, is to kill as many civilians as possible and maybe seize Mariupol to get a strategic victory before finding some way out of this thing.
I am not a military expert, no. So I will have to confess, I was naive. I was one of these lay people watching this war and thinking, you know, if only the Ukrainians can stop the Russians in their tracks, we win, right? I thought that was a victory scenario. Then the Russians, I don't know, in my head, I just thought they would go home. I'm sure a lot of us thought they would, you know, lose. There was a word that I started to hear from the military analysts that I'm sure you heard too. Culminated. Did you hear this word?
Yeah, strange word.
A culmination. What is it? Well, culmination apparently in the military terms means you're done. Right? You have accomplished what you can accomplish with the resources you have. In this case, the Russian military in Ukraine. And so I thought, okay, so we won, right? And the answer is no. You end up in this thing that they call a stalemate. And I think of stalemate as, okay, nothing's happening, right? But what they're explaining to us is stalemate means, oh, no, the Russians are sitting there. They're not advancing, but they're just going to pummel the living daylights out of the Ukrainians. And when we say the Ukrainians, right, we're not talking about the military. They are killing Ukrainian military, but they're just shelling the cities, as you're pointing out. And so this stalemate consists of more and more Ukrainians dying every day. And I'm just at a loss for what to do in this situation where we technically won the first stage of the war, and yet the losses in human terms are just incalculable.
Well, nobody loses a war until they're willing to admit defeat. This is something that I think General Hurtling made this point. What will it take for Vladimir Putin to admit that he has been defeated? I can't even imagine a scenario. So we're hearing now, I think the Wall Street Journal has a report about the Russian plan B, which is to achieve some strategic victory, Mariupol, and then perhaps use that as leverage to negotiate Ukrainian neutrality. I cannot imagine the Ukrainians agreeing to neutrality. But you're right. I mean, now it is just simply this this war of attrition where the Ukrainians are trying to attrit the Russian forces and are having tremendous success doing that, but the Russians trying to reduce as many cities as possible. Look, I know that war is hell, but it's very clear now that there is no indiscriminate bombing of civilians, that it's very discriminate, it's very intentional, that what the Russians have done is, rather than focusing on fighting anything close to a conventional war, they've kind of morphed into just raw terrorism. I mean, how else do you describe what they're doing to civilian populations other than state-sponsored terrorism, trying to terrorize the civilian populations of Ukrainian cities?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Charlie. I mean, what you're making me think of course, is that the entire premise of U.S.-Russian cooperation in previous years, since 2000 or whatever, has been anti-terrorism, right? And that was what the Russians presented themselves as. Like, we're going to help the other big powers unite against terrorism. And what they meant was Arab terrorists, right, or Muslim terrorists. And what's actually happened is that Russia has become the largest terrorist in the world, right? They're just deliberately killing people to achieve a political objective, which is the definition of terrorism. I keep thinking of the guy, you remember this, I think it's like 5 years ago, the guy in Las Vegas who goes and gets a hotel room up on the top of some, you know, fancy hotel, busts out the windows, has like a dozen AR-15s, and just opens fire and just massacres. He killed like 60 people, wounded another 400. I mean, it's this, and we call that mass murder. What do we call what the Russians are doing, right? They have bigger guns. They're killing more people. It just feels like this isn't war. This is mass murder.
Well, and I think there's a disconnect because we think, you know, that the world will look on this in horror and will recoil from this brutality. I think that Vladimir Putin sees this brutality, the carnage, as a net positive for him, because what he's got going for him is he wants to cow his opponents, he wants to terrify them, he wants them to never even think about rising up against him. He's sending a message to all of the other countries, you know, that he is not going to be constrained by what we think of as modern civilized rules of warfare. And I have to say, and I'm sorry to keep referencing this, but you know, while I'm watching what's going on in Ukraine, I am rereading Robert Massey's magnificent biography of Peter the Great. And I'm at the section now where Peter the Great is still, I think he's 25, 26 years old. He has just returned from a long embassy in Western Europe where he had learned, you know, a lot about Western values. Comes back to find that there had been a military revolt, a revolt of certain troops. I think it's pronounced the Streltsy, but somebody will correct me on this. And his response, which is the response of tyrants going back many centuries, is to engage in mass torture and then mass public executions. So every single day, dozens and dozens and dozens, hundreds of people are beheaded or they are hanged in public in Moscow. And the Western ambassadors are horrified and shocked by all this. He tries to keep it something of a secret. But the strategy there, the statescraft, is that he wants to send a message to anyone who would think of challenging his complete autocratic power. And so the use of terror is something that is not unfamiliar to history and is certainly not unfamiliar to Russian history. And we could come up with much more recent Russian history to illustrate that as well.
Yeah. And I guess I would distinguish there between terrorism and ruthlessness, right? That's, yeah. I mean, terrorism per se, that technically you're trying to achieve a political objective. Is it usually against another country? Anyway, I would like to put on the table a big question here, and I'm just beginning to think about it, which is ruthlessness is an advantage. We know this, right? We know that Putin's willingness to massacre Ukrainians, his willingness to treat his own troops as cannon fodder, allows him to continue the war when other people might sue for peace, right? He may get some concessions out of Zelensky and the Ukrainians because they just want to stop the killing and Putin doesn't mind. On the other hand, there is this larger, you know, global geopolitical thing going on where Putin has managed to unite the world, the free world, against him. How has he done that? By ruthlessly killing people, yeah. Right? So the ruthlessness, at the same time as it is an advantage, is in public relations terms, to the extent that human beings are moral, a disadvantage. And I just don't know how that equation is going to play out over time.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, all fascists think that ruthlessness is, in fact, you know, an advantage, that it works for them. And look, I mean, I know this becomes circular, but you know, Vladimir Putin has a lot of reason to believe that ruthlessness works for him. And because he's seen, you know, in the past, he saw what happened in Chechnya. I mean, he committed one war crime after another. He got away with it. He committed one war crime after another. He was ruthless. He was terrorist. He behaved in a terrorist fashion in Syria, and he got away with it. He invaded Ukraine, got away with it, invaded Georgia. The world looked the other way. So somebody used the quote the other day on the program that there's a Russian adage that the appetite grows with eating, and his appetite keeps getting bigger and bigger, and the West has not figured out how to respond to him until now. In fact, I'm not sure that they've figured this out.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what the West is doing and what the Ukrainians are doing in response to the ruthlessness and the extent to which the ruthlessness is driving that, right? Like, so the West, clearly we've united countries that didn't previously unite against Russia, say in terms of shedding their dependence on Russian energy or, you know, being willing to implement larger sanctions. And that's been driven by these images of the ruthlessness that Putin and his forces are engaged in. There's the sheer will of the Ukrainians to resist, which is being driven by, you know, these Russians are coming in and killing us, right? So that in itself has become a force against Putin. And then there's the question of what happens within Russia, right? I mean, to the extent that Putin treats his own soldiers, that they don't even like, they let the soldiers, the wounded, just die. You know, they don't pick, they don't take their bodies with them. They don't tell the families what's going on. Will there be an uprising? You know, there's, I saw a report, there have been 15,000 arrests in Russia for protesting the war. Will the ruthlessness of Putin with respect to Russians themselves and his own soldiers eventually drive some sort of revolt inside Russia? I don't
know. But all indications are that the vast majority of Russians still support what he's doing, at least based on the polls, including some of the independent polls. He controls the media. I do think you have a generation gap there. And of course, most of the soldiers are from a younger generation. So you kind of wonder how that plays out. You can't have this many casualties. You can't have this kind of a disaster without the word getting out. You just can't. I understand there's a long tradition of trying to pretend that failures are successes, but I just don't know how he pulls that. I don't know how he pulls that off. So in terms of ruthlessness, though, let's talk about the next step. Big debate over the weekend on the question of red lines, because there's growing fear on the part of Western intelligence agencies that Vladimir Putin may possibly use chemical weapons or other kinds of bioweapons. He seems to be laying the predicate for that by engaging in these false flag, accusing the Ukrainians of having bio labs, false information that somehow is being repeated by the useful idiots in this country, including a host on Fox News. But the question then becomes, what do we do? What is our response if Vladimir Putin escalates by using weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine, in this war? So Senator Chris Murphy, we have Chris Murphy and then Liz Cheney. Here's Senator Chris Murphy, who's asked this question on Meet the Press.
Is chemical weapons a red line for the United States government, in your mind? Should it be for the Biden administration when it comes to whether we do a no-fly zone and get more involved in Ukraine militarily?
Yeah, listen, I think we need to make clear to the Russians that our level of commitment to the Ukrainians and our participation in this conflict is going to be proportional to the tactics that the Russians use inside of Ukraine. There is no doubt that we have dramatically stepped up the transfer of weapons to Ukraine since the Russians have begun this brutal campaign of targeting civilians. We've sent drones. We have sent new anti-tank missiles, $1 billion of assistance in the last week. So I don't think the United States needs to draw specific red lines today. I think we just need to make clear to the Russians that our involvement in this war is going to increase if their tactics targeting civilians also increase.
So, Will, what does that mean? He says, make it clear. He doesn't make it clear. And then he says, we will have a proportional response. But he doesn't say what that is. What is a proportionate response to the use of chemical weapons?
So the first answer to your question is, I don't know, Charlie.
Yeah.
I mean, you've raised this very good question about self-deterrence, right? That we've said what we won't do in response to Putin, and we haven't said a lot about what we will do. And what I keep hearing, the argument on the other side is sort of that ambiguity in deterrence is somehow advantageous. It's good not to say exactly what you will do. But then if you're going to do that, right, you need to make clear that the unclear thing that you're going to impose in response to, say, chemical weapons is not nothing, right? So somehow you have to say, so we're going to do something, but what I'm just not sure Putin will believe that we're going to do something if we don't specify what it is.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, he's thinking, okay, you know, he's heard basically, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this, we are not going to risk World War III. He uses the chemical weapons, we go, okay, that's really bad. We're going to be proportionate. What is proportionate to chemical weapons? And I got to tell you, unless you spell it out, that's anything but clear to me. We are going to provide chemical weapons. I think that's highly unlikely, as in no. that we will provide them with nuclear weapons? No. So again, I'm just not sure that there's anything that we are doing or saying now that deters him from doing that. Okay, let's go to Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney was asked the same question.
I think that it should be, Chuck. And I think that we in the West, the United States and NATO, we need to stop telling the Russians what we won't do. We need to be very clear that we are considering all options, that the use of chemical weapons is certainly something that would alter our calculation. And we need to understand that, you know, we shouldn't be in the business of, some have called it self-deterrence. Mm-hmm. Putin's actions so far have demonstrated, first of all, that the Russian military is nowhere near as capable as the world perhaps thought it was, probably not as capable as Putin thought it was. And they need to understand that if the brutality here increases, the United States will contemplate and consider every possible range of actions along with our NATO allies. And I think it's important that they know that we will contemplate changing the calculation in terms of humanitarian challenges.
Okay. But again, what is she talking about? So she says we should make it a red line. But of course, red line has complicated history. Barack Obama famously drew that red line about chemical weapons in Syria. President Assad basically said, you know, I don't believe you. I'm going to cross the red line. And we did absolutely nothing. So even with Liz Cheney, who's channeling my line about, you know, that we've been engaging in self-deterrence, what are we talking about here? I don't know what we're talking about, quite honestly. And I'm guessing if you and I don't know what we're talking about, then Vladimir Putin's going to go, yeah, you know, big talk, but they won't cross any red line. I mean, let's face it, you know, the West has drawn its own red line. We're not going in. We're not sending troops. We're not going to roll tanks in. We're not going to send planes in. We're not going to do any of that stuff. So what are we talking about?
Well, okay, in defense of the West has already done a bunch of things, right? We've imposed the sanctions. We've sent in various kinds of weapons. We sent in, you know, the lower class of, you know, anti-tank, anti-aircraft missiles. And now we're sending, apparently, we're trying to get the higher class in, the S-300s. So we have taken measures that would give a signal to Putin of what might be ahead, right? That we've shown some seriousness by what we've done. However, I think you're right there. I mean, I just wrote down what Liz Cheney said. And Liz Cheney is supposed to be the paradigm, right? She's supposed to be the person who shows what real deterrence in a red line is like. And her phrase was, what will we do? We will do, quote, every possible range of actions.
Such as
we're
what?
Back where we were.
Which will really, really be mad. And we're just going to rummage back through our, you know, bag of stuff here and like, okay, you have what? Nuclear weapons. What are you talking about? I mean, I'd like to know. And I think that in terms of deterring Vladimir Putin, we have to do something to make him nervous about what we will do. But it seems as if we have made ourselves so nervous about what he will do that we're unwilling to do that.
Yeah, in defense of the ambiguity people, the people who advocate for being ambiguous in your deterrence, they might have some evidence that this tends to work better than being clear exactly about, like, for example, the argument might be if you tell people exactly what you're going to do, in Putin's case, he says, okay, I'll budget for those sanctions or whatever they are. And now I'm going to use the chemical weapons because I know I can handle what you told me you're going to do. If I don't know what you're going to do, I don't know. It could be something really scary. So, but I would like to see evidence, Charlie. I like to be evidence-based. What is the historical record of ambiguous threats as opposed to clear threats in deterring this kind of behavior?
This is a good question because these folks that are engaging in the ambiguity have been basically playing that card since, what, 2008? And how's that worked out?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know, I mean, not to go back and revisit our debate from last Monday, but I'm just, you know, what have we deterred him from doing? I am concerned about all of this, you know, where it's going, because I think the patience of the world, it's wearing thin in terms of just watching the human horror. And, you know, part of this is we could go, well, we've had horror before. We've seen this before. There is something qualitatively different about seeing it on your television screen, on your social media screen every hour of every day. And if you have actual, you know, chemical weapons, people will say, well, it will play out the same way it played out in Syria. No, I don't think it will play out the same way. And so I don't know what the reaction will be, the political reaction and the kind of political pressure that that we're seeing. Now, Joe Biden and President Biden will be in Europe this week, will be going to Poland. I think that's a really good idea. I think that he needs to be on scene here. But Mona Chernin and I talked about this last week. At what point does Joe Biden need to use his bully pulpit more? Where is the prime time address to the American people about this? I know that he talked about it during the State of the Union, but are there things that Joe Biden could be doing rhetorically? I mean, we're seeing the power of presidential leadership and rhetoric coming from Volodymyr Zelensky. We're not seeing the same level from Joe Biden. And I've made this point before, but I wanted to get your take on it.
Well, okay, I revert to my longstanding view of Joe Biden, which is that although I voted for Joe Biden, Joe Biden is a bad speaker. He's just, I mean, he's old, he's tired, he doesn't sort of drive a message well, he doesn't have the energy, and everybody can see it. And that's why, you know, we, all of us pundits, why doesn't Joe Biden say this? Why doesn't he say that? He just can't. He's just not good at that. Even when the message is very clear and simple and morally straightforward, right? I think it's okay that Volodymyr Zelensky is taking up that role. The fact that we have, you know, that Zelensky, look, in defense of the United States, I don't know what our guys have done in there, but we've clearly have like made sure that they have, we've helped, somebody has helped make sure that Zelensky maintains solid communication to the outside world. This guy who's under siege, so sort of in Kyiv, right, can speak to our parliament, the Congress, other parliaments, other governments. He just video addresses everywhere. So he's driving the message for the world. So Biden doesn't exactly have to do that. That's okay. But, you know, it would help if the president of the United States were part of that. Yeah. I will say one thing in Biden's defense. Biden has done one thing that we are taking for granted, but that, say, the previous president would not have been able to do, and that is he has united the allies. Yeah. And without that unity, these sanctions don't work. Sanctions absolutely do not work if it's just, you know, Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump standing up and saying, America will do the following. America just doesn't have that pull in terms of its percentage of the global GDP that it used to have. So we absolutely need the allies. And Biden has done that, and it's been behind the scenes, and let's give him credit for it.
Okay, so the other big story this week, overshadowed by what's going on in Ukraine, of course, is the latest partisan fight over the U.S. Supreme Court and Ketanji Brown Jackson's moment in the barrel. So, Will, let's talk about that right after this. Refinancing your mortgage can make a big difference in your life, especially with today's low rates. I mean, you could save up to $1,000 a month. That's the kind of money that can be used to pay off debts, invest, improve your home. It's totally up to you. As long as you call American Financing, America's home for home loans, they're a proud sponsor of this show. American Financing provides a no-pressure experience that's focused on you. You never pay upfront or hidden fees either because they truly care about saving you the most amount of money. So what are you waiting for? Take advantage of a free mortgage review now and see what they can do for you. If you start soon, you could close in as fast as 10 days. Call 888-991-9788. That's 888-991-9788. Or visit AmericanFinancing.net and tell them that Charlie sent you. NMLS 182334, NMLSConsumerAccess.org. Okay, we're back with Will Salatan. Obviously, Ukraine is taking up most of the oxygen, but let's talk about what starts today, the hearings for KBJ, who is in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Can I just put these put this whole process in some context? Because I like to geek out on some of this stuff. So she, at the end of this process, she's likely to be confirmed on either a straight party line vote or a near party line vote. Maybe Susan Collins will vote for her, Lisa Murkowski. I don't know, Mitt Romney. You know, what do you think? I mean, 2-3 possible Republican votes. I don't see many more than that.
Yeah, I'm going to bet under 60 votes total.
Okay, sure. I mean, it's probably going to be around, you know, 52, 53 votes. But again, there are no scandals. Her credentials stack up very impressively against other nominees. And, you know, it seems like something from the distant mists of time, but it didn't used to be this way, right? I mean, you know, at one time, qualified nominees were routinely passed by overwhelming bipartisan votes. So here's a reminder. Antonin Scalia, confirmed by the Senate on a vote of, wait for it, 98-0. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, confirmed 96-3. The justice that Judge Jackson is going to replace Stephen Breyer was confirmed by a margin of 87-9. All right. I mean, you go back. Okay. Sandra Day O'Connor, confirmed by the Senate, 99-0. Thurgood Marshall got 69 votes when he was confirmed back in 1967. Okay. More recently, as recently as 2010, Elena Kagan got 63 votes. The year earlier, Sonia Sotomayor was confirmed 68-31. Okay, so Clarence Thomas got only 52 votes. Robert Bork was actually rejected, and the votes have been increasingly partisan. But we really have had a dramatic change in our political culture involving the court, because there was once an assumption that you didn't vote against somebody simply on ideology, you would vote on qualifications, but that has been completely turned on its head, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I guess this is just a very stark example of the decline of institutionalism, right? The decline, meaning the people's faith in institutions, the idea that, look, the Supreme Court is an institution, there are certain criteria for being qualified for this, and this person is qualified regardless of whether they lean left or right in their average of rulings, right? And so we approve them based on that. No, everything now is, does it help your team or my team? So, you know, there are relatively few senators left who will vote on that. And it's symptomatic also of the increasing polarization. It's not just left versus right. It's that the stakes are so enormous, we can't. Even, Charlie, it's so greedy for these Republican senators who already now have six guaranteed seats on the Supreme Court. We're talking about the seventh. And, you know, to be refusing the nominee because she's somehow might be progressive in terms of the rights of the accused or something like that. It just seems greedy.
Yeah, but they're not actually going to try to reject her. They're just going to try to smear her and then score their own points. I mean, I think the game that you're going to see, you know, it will be exemplified by the usual suspects, people like, you know, Josh Hawley of insurrectionist fist bump fame. He's going to be leading the charge against KBJ. And he's latched on to child pornography, which I think is interesting, that of all of the things out there that he's decided to go with this theme. And in my newsletter, I quote Don Moynihan, who thinks that this is kind of Q adjacent, that this is all part of this effort to, you know, keep raising the issues of, you know, child molestation that are out there. We've seen this push by charlatans like Christopher Rufo, who's moved on from CRT to more gender-based issues, you know, talking about we need to use words like predator and grooming more often. And so Josh Hawley sees this as an opportunity to enhance his deplorable credentials by going after the child porn on the child porn issue. And to give you a sense of how cynical it is, virtually all of the fact checkers are saying that his analysis is bullshit. It's disingenuous. It's dishonest. Even National Review, Andrew McCarthy, has a headline: Senator Hawley's disingenuous attack against Judge Jackson's record on child pornography. So what you're going to get on display is once again, you know, what's happening to the right-wing political ecosystem.
Right. And of course, the fact that this is Josh Hawley leading this and that it is an openly cynical charge, they're closely related, right? Because Josh Hawley represents this sort of modern style of politics, which is fundamentally unserious. It's not about governing, right? It's not about making a good decision on a Supreme Court nomination. It's about grabbing some attention, raising some money, raising your profile. Yep. This is a completely cynical operation on Hawley's part. He doesn't actually intend to stop the nomination. He intends to make a name for himself by being the guy who stood up and shouted child pornography. And as you pointed out in your newsletter, the child pornography charge is openly cynical, right? The language that Rufo and these other people are using is they say this in their tweets, as you point out, right? They say, use this language. They're talking to their own people. Call them predators. Call them groomers, right? It's that the words are only important to these people for their political effect, for scoring points. And the fact that they would do this about child pornography, about sexual abuse of children, one of the vilest things in the universe, it just illustrates the depth of their depravity and their unseriousness.
Well, I agree with you. Now, the one thing that you and I definitely do not want to do on this Monday, this particular Monday, is talk about cancel culture and free speech. So let's do it anyway.
Well, because I don't know. It is interesting that we've had this debate break out again. I think it's appropriate, given the fact that we're watching this ongoing clash between democracy and autocracy played out. So let's have a debate about the nature of liberalism and illiberalism. New York Times had this editorial over the weekend that really set off. It triggered folks, mainly on the left, which was kind of interesting. So the New York Times comes out and says, hey, we have a free speech problem in this country. And their first paragraph read, for all the tolerance and enlightenment that modern society claims, Americans are losing hold of a fundamental right as citizens of a free country, the right to speak their minds and voice their opinions in public without fear of being shamed or shunned. And I wrote about this yesterday. I think that overstates the problem and understates it at the same time, although I think they generally got it right. Just spoiler there. Simple matter of constitutional law, there's no fundamental right to be free from fear of being shamed or shunned, right? So that is an overstatement. But I also think they understate the problem because the threats to free speech aren't just shunning and shaming. I mean, people lose their jobs. They're shouted down. They can't teach. They can't publish. There's a lot going on here. But I wanted to ask you about this, Will. It seems like a lot of the reaction from folks from the left is that, well, the great sin here is to imply that this is a problem that both sides are guilty of. And both sidesism has become a form of heresy. Now, my take is, yeah, you don't have to believe that they're equally, bad, but the reality is the attacks on liberalism, the illiberalism, comes from both the right and the left. So why is that become a thing on the left? Don't ever suggest that we have contributed to any of this whatsoever, and we are not going to confront our own illiberalism, because I think that in itself is kind of dangerous.
Yeah, well, okay, first of all, let me say where I come from in this debate. I am a libertarian on this, which means your first point that you don't have a right to speak without fear of being shamed or shunned. That's, to me, that's the most important thing. We see around the world authoritarian countries where you'll get arrested, right? You go to Russia, you protest the war, they haul you off and put you in a paddy wagon and whatever. So it's very important that we just maintain the legal right. And then within that, you and I and everybody else can have an argument about the shaming and the shunning. And we can shame the shunners and shun the shamers and all that, right? And that's part of cultural debate. That's healthy. And that's what we're doing. The point that I would say in response to your question about the left is, the left, unlike the right, has this illusion about itself, which is that shaming and shunning and, moralizing is a property of conservatism, right? Hmm. That only the people on the right, Bible thumpers, that those are the people who tell everybody what to do and who, we believe in live and let live, says the left. But of course, that's not true. It's not true because it's in human nature to moralize, right? We judge other people. Progressives judge other people all the time. I cannot believe you're wearing that coat, right? How can you wear that coat? It is made of the wrong stuff. It is from the wrong country. It was made with child labor, whatever. So that kind of behavior goes on the left, and yet they don't see it in themselves. And so when you call them out on it, you say, stop shaming, stop shunning, stop isolating, a professor who said something that you found offensive. They just don't recognize themselves as behaving that way.
I think that's right. But the reason I said it, I think it's dangerous, is because, let's face it, I heard somebody say the other day, well, conservative principle supports free speech. The reality is there's a long history there. And if free speech had been in the care of conservatives, it would have been an endangered species for a very, very long time. And things have gotten worse. I mean, I thought Jonathan Last was absolutely right when he said, if we're talking about conservative in the wild, there's no longer any interest in free speech except as a cudgel with which to pursue power against political opponents. So you're seeing this very, very aggressive, anti-speech effort, banning books, banning ideas, telling schools what they can do and what they can't do. But
it does strike me that the response from the left is muted because they have accepted the idea that speech that makes you uncomfortable should be, I don't know, silenced or censored. They have accepted the idea, or many of them have accepted, I'm obviously, you know, generalizing here, but there are folks on the left who have bought into the idea of certain kinds of speech being violence, conflating speech with violence. So if people on the left do not support this and people on the right have cynically abandoned it, then we're in a difficult situation. What I'm really afraid of is the fact that you have this sort of, you know, two-pronged attack of illiberalism is exposing the fact that what we had thought of as a broad consensus in favor of tolerance and free speech is much thinner and much more vulnerable than we had thought.
Yeah, okay. So I'll agree with you on that. However, we tend to think that things are worse than they used to be, and we forget how bad they were, right? Yeah. So there was no good old days about free speech, you can argue. I mean, what you're reminding me of, Charlie, is when I was a college student, you know, decades ago, and I remember using the phrase verbal rape. So we accused somebody of verbal rape, right? So that kind of language, the conflation between violence and speech that you're talking about, was going on the whole time. And maybe we now have more of a political debate about what goes on college campuses, but so that was always there. To your point about the right, though, I said before, I just bashed my friends on the left and said, you guys don't admit that you're moralizing all the time. On the right, there's increasingly this trick that they use to justify their censorship, which is, oh, we're still libertarian. We still believe in limited government. We're not restricting speech. But somehow the government here is paying for, say, a professor at a state university.
Yeah.
And therefore we can tell them what they can't say. And so they make it a funding question when it's really just an attempt to use the funding as leverage for the censorship.
Okay, so can I make this harder?
Go ahead.
Since we're doing this on a podcast, let's make this all this more difficult. Some people do deserve to be canceled. I mean, let's be honest about this. There are red lines that we have discussed in the past. If you are engaging in, you know, raw racist speech, if you are peddling disinformation, if you are lying, then I think it's legitimate to say that you shouldn't have certain platforms. I don't have a problem with people saying, you know what, if a host on Fox News is peddling Russian disinformation, peddling the big lie about the election, and spreading disinformation about, you know, life-saving vaccines, then, you know, I think it is legitimate to say that they should not have that platform. But part of the question is, when we talk about cancel culture, is at what point, where do we draw those red lines? Because I guess I am a libertarian, but I don't think that people have, I mean, on the one hand, I don't think that anyone has a right not to be offended, but I don't think that people have the right to have massive bullhorns, megaphones, and, you know, national platforms to spread, you know, vile hate speech and deception. So where do we draw that? Because you can denounce cancel culture, but also recognize, you know, some folks actually do deserve to be canceled. I think Josh Hawley deserves to be canceled.
Yeah, okay.
I just said it, you know?
So I'm with you on this, too, but up to a point. To me, the question is, what is the method of cancellation, right? If the method of cancellation is within the boundaries of free speech, like, so Tucker Carlson is on, you know, TV every day, you know, undermining all that is good and right and helping, you know, evil. So What do we do about that, right? If the government must never take Tucker Carlson off the air, we don't want to become like Russia, right? We don't want to become like China. But if the method of cancellation is a lot of Americans saying to Fox News, this is vile, this is wrong, this is evil, we're going to like not support having Fox in our cable packages anymore if there's a boycott or something like that, that's totally within the boundaries of free speech, right? You're exercising your economic power. And if Fox News decides that it's, you know, not in their financial interest to be supporting that anymore, you know, that's okay. Yes, this can be abused. Economic power boycotts can be abused, but it's not the same thing as the government censoring.
There's no question about it. But as a perfect example, so that we're not engaging in just complete abstractions here, I wrote down a couple of ideas of things that I might write about later this week. And one of the things on my list is, can we talk about Leah Thomas? Do you want to talk about Leah Thomas? Do you know what I mean here? Leah Thomas,
yeah,
of course, is the transgender swimmer who is blowing away all of the women in the NCAA. You want to talk about a massive gap between public opinion and elite opinion. This is one, because the polls would suggest that people see something fundamentally unfair in this issue of sports. So there is a big gap there. And I also think that there's a gap between what people say in private and what they're willing to say in public, because you don't want to talk about this, do you? Because you know what's going to happen. Will is okay. Sitting there going, shit. Yeah.
I am, in fact. I am. Okay, so here's the shit part, Charlie. The shit part is...
talk about Leah Thomas.
Okay, so the part of it that's like... That
Will's going to go into one of his hipster coffee shops and someone's going to hear it and it's going to like, oh, man.
Okay, let me be the lib. Let me be the lib for 30 seconds.
All right.
Here's the lib take on this, right? Charlie, there are literally hundreds and thousands of people being killed in Ukraine right now. And so why are we talking about a transgender swimmer? Okay, I've just done the lib take. It is a valid point, right? This is a very small issue. And it's sort of like what Fox News looks for when there's a much bigger thing going on. Having said that, I don't disagree with you about the fundamental question here. Right. The fundamental question is, should somebody have an unfair biological advantage? We don't let biological males who may remain identified as men compete in women's sports. Right. That's just unfair. Why would we let one who now identifies as a woman? Let's grant this person is mentally and we'll just say accept the progressive premise, sure, is a woman, but has an unfair physical advantage, the same unfair physical advantage. You know, so rule number one, go with science, go with evidence. And the science here, the evidence is Leah Thomas has an unfair advantage. She should not be able to compete. Now, is that anti-trans? Very simple way to answer that question. What happens if a swimmer goes from a swimmer who is born biologically female wants to compete in men's sports, right? Would we allow that? My answer is yes. And the reason is it does not give that athlete an advantage. In fact, it's a biological disadvantage on average to have been born female in athletics. So if you draw that distinction, you are not taking an anti-trans position. You are taking a position against unfair advantage.
I think you're right on that. And I think that this is the distinction that, believe it or not, I think that people can make this distinction. I think it's unfortunate that this has become stigmatized, but you can believe several things at the same time. And I don't think they're contradictory, which is to respect and affirm someone who has made her choice, say that she knows she should be respected and that she should not be discriminated against. On the other hand, recognize the fundamental unfairness of this situation and the particular unfairness to other women, because this is the end of women's sports if, in fact, this became more widespread. Now, you mentioned that, you know, this is it's a limited problem. I remember about a year ago that when this became an issue and you had some bad faith politicians who were trying to exploit it, one of the defenses was, the pushbacks was, well, there are no transgender athletes in high school. It doesn't exist. They're going after a non-existent problem. Well, the problem is it is now a real problem. It is tangible. And I think people need to understand why more than 60% of Americans have a problem with this. So, you know, for people who would say, you know, how many genders are there? In sports, there are only two genders. In sports, it is strictly binary. There's men's sports and there's women's sports. To be consistent, if there are multiple genders, then perhaps we ought to have multiple categories for sports. That the fair solution would be you have men's sports, you have women's sports, and you have transgender sports. I don't know, as long as it's binary, how you don't recognize the fundamental unfairness of this. And it was so illustrated. I mean, the thing about Leah Thomas is, you know, she was so dominant that, and, you know, clearly was able to win things as a woman that she would not have been able to win if she was competing against biological males. And so it is so stark. It's the worst possible issue, I think, for progressives to use as a litmus test for whether or not you are a bigot or a progressive.
Okay. Now, I largely agree with all of that. And what I would add to it is a message to my friends on the left who, you know, whose hackles go up over an issue like this. So you look at this and you say, I cannot believe those bastards at Fox News have, like, you know, in the midst of a war, have seized on this petty thing about this one swimmer and they're attacking it. All right. There are two ways to deal with that. there are probably more than two ways in the spirit of non-binary to deal with it, but I'm going to just talk about two. Number one is you deny it. You say, I'm not going to talk about that. How dare you attack Leah Thomas? You know, you are a bigot, and let's get back to the important stuff, right? Second way of dealing with it is grant it. They're right. Say, you know what? On the transgender swimmer, you're right. Right? She should not be able to compete in the women's sports because she has an unfair advantage. And now let's move on and talk about the important thing.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with saying, no, we're against defunding the police, and now let's talk about how we can solve crime. No, we're against, you know, an unfair advantage in sports, and now let's get on with talking about other issues. I think the second approach is entirely morally valid, and it's certainly more politically effective.
Well, I agree with you completely there. Maybe you could, you know, pass that word next time you go to one of your hipster coffee shops. So what else do you want to talk about this week? What are you keeping your eye on for the rest of the week?
Well, you know, I was struck by, I saw Liz Cheney do her interview this weekend, and she used two words that I think are going to be really important when she was talking about the January 6th committee, the investigation. And she said, in talking about Donald Trump and his complicity and his responsibility, she said, I'm just going to like read you the quote, which I wrote down here. She said, what we're looking at, we, the committee, do we need additional enhanced criminal penalties for the kind of dereliction of duty that you saw with President Trump when he refused to tell the mob to go home after he had provoked that attack on the Capitol? And that was super interesting to me that she used the words go home, because there is this distinction that a lot of people don't really notice when we talk about January 6th. And that is Donald Trump did go on Twitter and tell people at, you know, in 2:30 in the afternoon after a bunch of violence had been committed, hey, tone it down, guys. Don't be so violent. Don't attack the police. But what we found out in the text messages that were being sent to Donald Trump was he was not just being asked to say that. He was being asked to say, to tell the crowd to go home, right? You have thousands of people at the Capitol. It's a huge security crisis, right? All kinds of bad stuff can happen. Tell them to disperse. That's normal behavior. And that was the phrase Donald Trump refused to use. And the fact that Liz Cheney said this tells me that the committee is going to make that a focus of their indictment, literal indictment, their criticism, their moral indictment of President Trump for what he failed to do.
I think there had been a lot of expectation that they were going to have these public hearings in March or April. And then as we got to the turn of the year, there was some suggestion that might be pushed back as they continue to put together the case. In some ways, the shift of public opinion from the spotlight off of them gives them a little bit more breathing room, I think, to put together this case. And I think you're absolutely right about this, that you can see that one of the things that they are increasingly focused on is what is the specific culpability and accountability of President Trump? What are the standards by which he ought to be held accountable for what happened on January 6th? So that story is obviously not going away. And look, we have limited attention spans. I hope that we don't take our eye off Ukraine before it's done, especially as this slog goes on. And I'm very interested to see what happens to public opinion. You have a piece in the Bulwark today, which I would recommend. I would say the public opinion right now is in flux, that you had a lot of people who are very isolationist, who have now become very hawkish, you know, in the first weeks of the war. It will be interesting to see where it goes if this becomes a long stalemate and a slog. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, to me, the huge question here is, will reality change public opinion? That is to say, there has been kind of, one of the things that I found in looking at this polling was, there has been a realignment. We've all noticed signs of it, but I just documented it, a realignment of Republicans away from muscular foreign policy, towards isolationism, towards non-intervention in the world. And it's come up against an attack by a superpower, a brutal attack, murdering a lot of people in Ukraine, and it's going on for weeks and weeks. And to me, the question is, will that reality of evil push Republicans back in the direction of asserting a role for America in the world? And I think there are signs of it, but I was really disheartened to see the poll numbers that I saw even as late as this last week. And so I just don't know, Charlie. I just don't know how that struggle between the isolationism and the reality of the evil is going to end up.
No, and again, it's a very interesting moment in Republican politics where you have the vast majority of elected Republicans who are supporting an aggressive approach to Russia. And then you have the right now somewhat isolated MAGA voices who are, you know, the Steve Bannons of the world, but Never underestimate the power of the entertainment wing of the Republican Party or of the MAGA wing, especially with Donald Trump sitting down there in Mar-a-Lago. I think that this trajectory would be completely different if Donald Trump was not the, you know, did not continue to be the leader of the Republican Party and the odds-on favorite to be the Republican nominee. If you take him out of this, I'd be much more confident in saying that I think that you would see the rise of a much more aggressive, muscular, interventionist Republican Party. But I don't see how they can do that while you have Vladimir Putin's most useful idiot sitting down there waiting for his restoration.
Yeah, but I don't think it's just Trump. I think that's I think your view, which I would love to believe, it feels optimistic to me that if Trump disappeared, if Trump walked away, who would be left? Okay, Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Steve Bannon, not a lot, right? But that's at the elite level. And the problem is the base of the Republican Party has bought into the isolationism. And it's not clear to me, Charlie, that the base has followed Trump so much as Trump followed the base. I just wonder to what extent the people at the base of the Republican Party don't care about the world anymore. And if that's true, and if the fundamental property of being a Republican politician these days is cowardice, which I believe is also true, will those politicians fold? Will they basically move over to the isolationist wing?
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, I think there are a lot of polls out there. I'm looking at the latest Pew numbers. The Republicans were, in fact, more likely than Democrats to say the U.S. is providing Ukraine with not enough support. Among conservatives, 54%. The largest political subsection in this survey that thought we were not doing enough was conservatives. So 54% of conservatives said we were not doing enough for Ukraine, whereas among Democrats as a whole, only 38% said we're not doing enough. So I think it's mixed, and I think it's in some turmoil.
Well, okay, here's my argument against that. Mm-hmm. I saw the same numbers you did.
Yeah.
I see Republicans when they're asked a general question, should we be tougher? Should we do more? Yeah. They say yes.
Yeah.
But then when you ask them any of the things that would entail, they beg off. They say no. Yeah. Not no, but they're less likely to say it than Democrats are. And they're surprisingly unlikely to support a lot of things, to support certain kinds of sanctions or military aid, defending allies, even the ones to which we have NATO commitments. So there's a vestigial thematic Republican interest in being tough, but the actions that toughness entails, Republicans have been derelict.
Well, okay, let's see here. So the numbers may not be as high as the Democrats, but the overwhelming majority of Republicans do support, for example, the tough sanctions, correct?
There is more support, right. There is more support than opposition, and that is a good sign.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with just simply the partisanship that if anything is associated with Joe Biden, if you say, do you support Joe Biden's decision to impose sanctions, Republicans will say, no, I don't. I'm not against anything that Brandon does. But again, I think it's going to be interesting because, you know, on the right, there are two different historical streams. I mean, you do have the long history of isolationism, America First isolationism on the right going back into the 1940s. But then you also have the Reagan-esque Cold Warrior, more militaristic tradition. And I think there's a little bit of a cognitive clash going on there. So, Will, thank you for joining me once again on Charlie and Will Monday.
Thank you, Charlie.
I actually said my own name. See, there's something weird about that. Anytime somebody starts referring to themselves in the third person, they just need to be slapped. So
Charlie, you just said themself. I can't believe it. You just went Leah Thomas on me.
I did. I actually did. I actually did do that. And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
I like things my way, my coffee, my schedule, and my treatment. So I talked to my doctor about self-injecting with the Vyvgart Hytrulo prefilled syringe, which contains efgartigimod alpha and hyaluronidase QVFC. It's injected under your skin, subcutaneously. It means I can inject in my space, on my time. It's my treatment, my way. Visit VyVgartMyWay.com. That's VYVGARTMyWay.com. And talk to your doctor about VyVgart Hytrulo, brought to you by Argenix.
Here's the truth. You could literally be adored by everyone and then come home and still get completely ignored by your own cat. It's classic cat behavior. But new Shiba Premium Puree is a lickable treat that changes all that. They're protein-rich, made with bone broth, and have the smooth, creamy texture cats go crazy for, especially when it's hand-fed. Yeah, it's more than a treat. It's a fast pass to favorite human status. So feed your cat Shiba and go from totally ignored to truly adored in just 12 days, guaranteed, or your money back. Learn more at Shiba.com.